This is the start of the second side of this tape, and Mr. Parkerfile will continue with this portion of the story, and Frank Young will question him or interview him on about this tape.
Mr. Parkerfile, in regard, you speak of the third beach and the fourth beach. Could you give it to us briefly what you mean by the fourth beach?
Well, during the periods of time, way back, we don't know just how long it was back, the Bering Sea was, instead of being at the present beach, was up at the fourth beach, and it concentrated the pay street there. And then as the sea receded, it concentrated what we call the third beach. That is the richest beach, and probably one of the richest pay streaks that's ever found in the world. And just why that most of this gold should have been found on the third beach is still a question among many. Then we have the we come to what we call the intermediate beach. I never mind on the intermediate, but my partners did it. I had took in after them. And it was not anywhere near as rich as the third beach. It was about a mile closer to the sea than the third beach. And then from there, we go down to what they call the second beach. And that second beach is about, I understand that this beaches were formed as the ocean or the sea receded. And of course, it's probably each one probably took thousands of years at each place. Then the second beach was the third, was the first inland beach found. That is, it was about somewhere around a half mile back of the present beach. Well, then we had what we call the submarine beach, and that submarine was only about somewhere not over a quarter of a mile back from the present beach, and it was deep, very deep. It was much deeper than the other, and no big fortunes were made on it, but there was much gold taken out of what they call there the submarine beach. They call it the submarine because it was way down below the present beach, and how that formed is for somebody else to figure out. And then the present beach where that started the gold rush to Nome was worked out early. It was even worked out before I came there. It didn't take long to work them out because they had their miners' meetings and there when they first come in, and they decided that each person would only have so much on the, some of them was only about 10 or 12 feet wide from the back of the beach to the water, and many of them would take out $2,000 or $3,000 just in that little strip, and it was shallow, and it was hard to work through because there's so much fine gold in it, and many of them made cloth or ripples out of old gunny sacks and old woolen blankets, which served well to save the fine gold. Well, anyway, they begin prospecting again. You ask how these beaches come. A bunch of the miners, they started to figure, maybe there's some money back of this first beach, and they started sinking holes, and they found this second beach, and it was never rich. It was a kind of a wage proposition. Nobody ever found much on it. Now, is any other questions you want to? Is that the?
Well, that was very interesting. To explain those beaches to us. Now you can go ahead with your story, Mr.
We're coming back to where I was talking about the third beach. Well, we worked there all winter. That is the winter of 1904 and 5, and we finally discovered that it had been washed out by Snake River. Well, speaking about this third beach, the most why the pans were so large, from the action of the ocean at that time, it's easy to see why it concentrated it more than what a creek would. The waves going back and forth, it concentrated it right down on a hard bedrock, and that's why the big pans, you'd get them right on bedrock. There's many fortunes made in along that third beach. After we got through prospecting there, why Mr. Obam, well, I don't know whether I asked him or he suggested, I don't remember now, he says, if you want to go into some business, I'll stake you. So I knew something about cooking and one thing or another, and I didn't know too much about the rest of the business, but I thought I did. So he staked me to start up a cafe in Nome, and we expected a big rush still coming in, and I thought, well, it looked pretty good, so I opened up a cafe, and I had probably the highest class bill there in Nome. In fact, I went at it too big. It was feeling my way along, and before the summer was over, I was broke, and the big rush never showed up as we expected. So I went on after that. I went back to Solomon, where I first landed, and took a job down there and worked around there for a year, around Solomon, Solomon River. And then in the summer of 1906, during about the middle of summer, I went to Deering to work on the Fairhaven ditch. They were building a ditch there then, the Fairhaven Mining Company. And I worked there for about 2 weeks on that ditch, and it was kind of a slave driving job. And I said to another fellow, I said, let's go out prospecting. He says, I'm with you. So we knew that we weren't too far from Candle, about maybe 40 miles. So we didn't even draw our pay. We just got some supplies from the cook, and we started out across country, went over across the Kugruk River and down the Kugruk River. And there we met an old fellow, two fellows of them, in a wagon. They were out there staking claims on the Kugruk River, and they asked us if we wanted to ride into Candle, where we're going, and we absolutely intended to go. So we got a ride from there on into Candle. This fellow that was with me, his name was, I forget his name now, Willis, I don't know how it's called, Bill Willis. We got a job there shoveling in up on Candle Creek on one of the benches there. We worked there for about 2 weeks. And then I went down to Tewalik, and we longshore there a while, and then we went back to Candle and to see if we could get another job there, and he got a job hauling coal from the coal mine. There was a coal mine on the Kugruk River supplying coal to the Candle Creek. But as it happened, we were right there during the first election of delegates to Alaska. Frank Lockheed was running for short term, Thomas Peale was running for the second term. And I knew Frank Lofty personally, but I didn't know Thomas Haley was a Fairbanks man. Anyway, we that's where I put my first boat in, at Canville. Now, this might be interesting about that railroad, though. When I come back and report the fall back to him, we were just building that railroad. Just got it finished. Would that be of any use?
Yes. Mr. Parkpile, to get back to mining on the beaches of Nome, I might ask you this question, which might sound a little foolish. I don't know if I'm asking another, but these people, including myself, that sometimes wonder, where did that gold come from? I mean to say, did it come from the creek? Come down the creek into the ocean, the sea water, and then from there the sea took over and washed it up on the beaches, or was it in the ocean? Where do you think it comes from?
No, I don't think it came from the ocean. We found there in places where we were mining little stringers of quartz with gold in it. And all the way from Anvil Mountain down to the beach, every once in a while, where men would be mining, they'd run across these little stringers in bedrock. Now, the action of the waves over all that time would wash these, naturally wash these stringers out, and that's where the gold came from. Of course, some of it come down from Anvil Mountain, because Anvil Creek itself was a very rich creek. There's millions of dollars come out of Anvil Creek alone. In fact, I think there was 2 or 3 million come out of just one claim. That's the Dappet Lindeberg claim, the one that first discovered the gold there.
That was the discoverer of gold.
Well, of course, they found it on the beach first, and then Jaffet Lindeberg, there was three of them, I don't know, Lindblom, and I forget how many, three of them. They were Laplander herders, and come over from St. Michael. It seems like that they'd heard something about some gold being on the beach of Nome, and they left this ranger herd. Beat it for Nome, and they happened to be the first ones there, and it looks like there. It seems to me, as I used to hear the stories, that the first fellow that found the, we never hear much about him, the first fellow that found beach gold on the beach. But anyway, when these Laplanders got all over it, why they went to Nome in a hurry and started prospecting on the creeks, and they of course, they didn't have to go far back to Anvil Creek, where it enters the hills. It was easy to prospect. Now, further down in the flats, of course, they wouldn't get the gold because it's deep. And that's where they first found it. Well, that was about 19, I don't know just the date, but once it was around about 19, or 1898 or 99. Well, then, there wasn't any more big strike after that to a third beach line and stuff, which I mentioned before. Of course, Anvil Creek was the richest creek out of the creeks, but there were two other creeks that were very rich. There was Dexter Creek, named after Dexter. I think his name was John Dexter, one of the first pioneers there. And then there was Glazer Creek. Glazer Creek, Dexter Creek, they just headed into each other. Dexter Creek ran in the Nome River, and Glazer Creek ran in the Snake River. But neither one of these creeks, although they were very rich, they were not as rich as Anvil Creek. And in fact, as I mentioned before, none of them was rich as the third beach line.
Well, that's very interesting to know.
Yeah, that's not his name of John, but I mean, any officer in the region around there yet.
Well,
Now, what do you remember about the villages you come in for? What do you remember about the native villages there and the way of life?
Well, when I first came to Nome, there weren't too many. In fact, there was not many natives there. I think probably the nearest native village was what they called Finrock or Finrock. There was a big village there. But the natives came to Nome to sell their wares, their skins, ivory, stuff like that.
But they were Eskimos, not Indians.
They were pure Eskimos. Hardly any breeds at all. They were pure Eskimos. All
you were there during the high water
floods
in 1908, 1911?
I was, yeah. They came, I remember that. I was there and they washed out quite a few buildings on Front Street. Yeah, that was on the seaside. They repaired them up again. And then when the fire came along, that was the big fire. Well, there was, I think there was two or three fires. There was one in fact, there was one fire in 1905 that got it to one side of Front Street. In fact, it took away that rest of the United Union. Although I walked off on it, I didn't notice anymore, but it burnt that up. It was lost anyhow, but in there. And then there was there were several other fires that took quite a bit of the town. But the big fire that just wiped Nome out was in 1934. I've just been there that summer. I was attending a school of the teachers there in that summer. It was 1934. When we got back home, we heard about the Nome wiped out. It seemed like it was a big deal. Weeds came along and swept. Didn't have a chance. Didn't have that wind, it was too high.
How would you tell us about how you come to be a teacher at Nome and what you encountered when you became a teacher there and some of the life that you had as a teacher?
Why, my wife and I, shortly after we were married, Sarah Whitehead, Sarah E. Whitehead. I'm getting ahead of my story. We were married in Rome in 1990. But I met her in Kansas, in Rome, for about 2 years. And then after we were married, we went outside. Fall of 1919. And we were out quite a few years. But before that, I had sold this quartz mine for a large sum of money and thought that I was sitting pretty. But when the year came up, at the end of the year, they refused to make any more payments. And so I was left high and dry with the family started. And I had to go work out there, so I went to work in the Navy out there for a year. And after we were out there, I looked at our different places. We came back, I was going to open up the quartz mine again, I had a job there with the T. Wallach Mining Company as a master mechanic. Well, I stayed there. We stayed there 3 years. My wife got the postmastership. But before going back, before we left Seattle, we had put our names in. I put our applications in for school teachers in the it was Alaska Bureau of Education at that time. Well, a fellow by the name of Lop was the head of it. The second time we went around to we had these two babies with us. The old Mary and Donna. He says, "I can't send you with those babies." So
we thought, well, that's all off. In fact, he had a job to the VA, teaching in the Cusco Quim. He had that just about ready to send us there. But anyway, we said, okay, well, let's go back to Campbell. So we went back to Campbell. And we were there then from 1925 to 1928. And the superintendent, we forgot all about this application to put in the school without a dead issue. But the superintendent of the school, George A. Morlander, came and made a trip to Campbell and asked us if we wanted to teach. So we asked all the pickers, and he said, well, he says, I've got one school opening, and I can't get any teachers to go there. He says, it's been a hard school, and out of the whole 11, it's a hard school. It's one of the largest schools. I think it's the second largest at Point Barrow. And he says, if you take it for 1 year, I'll move you to another school. So we agreed to take the school for the 1 year. And so we left in the fall. We went from Canada, and we moved everything all around Cotterview and up through the Hobuck Lake and up into Selvig Lake. And the Selvig village itself is situated about 12 miles from the mouth of the river, the mouth of Selvig River. We arrived there about sometime in early September. The Eskimo village was just a reception.
Do you remember
any of the names of the students from Rossdale? Do you remember Mr. Brown? No. Lady Person Washington, I'll be talking to him. Howard Brown from Howard Brown. He told me something.
Oh.
Howard Brown? No, I don't know. I was just thinking about Howard Brown, but I think I don't know him too well, but I know him when I see him. He belongs to the Eagle there, doesn't he? Yeah. Yeah. In fact, he was in one of the offices there for a while. Then he moved to Nome, and then he came back.
His mother taught school at Nome, and he was around the time that you were there.
Oh.
Back in the 1920s, around the 1920s.
Well, I knew several Browns in Nome. I knew this Brown, which they call a little trick Brown. In fact, I never got his name.
We'll have to terminate this case, start on tape number two.
This is the start of reel number four, and we're just down below Black Rapids Roadhouse on our trip from Anchorage back to Fairbanks from the Pioneer Convention. It's a dry road. We're clear out of the snow area, and we're almost down onto the Donnelly Flats, not quite.
Frank, you got anything to say about this country again?
Well, we're down now on the Donnelly Flats. Harry made a little mistake, but we'll be going up Donnelly Dome here in a short time, and the wind is blowing slightly, but we're going along good and enjoying the trip.
Okay, Frank. We'll move on to our next location. Andy, you got anything to say?
Not just now, Harry.
We've just passed the Donnelly Road Red House, and we're down here. We passed the buffalo and tried to take a picture of it, and now we've passed the hump over here onto the Donnelly Pass, and we've met a cow and two calves of moose. And I've taken a couple of televoto shots here to see how they come out. Now we're going to move on. There's some other people interested here and took a look at it too.
Dolly Young here will describe what she's seen on these boats and tell us a little about them.
Are we on?
Yes.
Okay. Dolly, we just seen this calm moose and two calves. Now, how old do you think these calves were?
About 6 months old.
You think they were two bulls or a calf?
They were built like bulls anyway. They had the big neck and shoulders.
Well, how long do these calves stay with the mother?
She stays with them till next spring, and then while they're asleep, she slips off and leaves them, and they're on their own then.
Well, where did you get this information?
Oh, I don't recall right now where it is, but I've heard that on down through the years through different trappers and hunters that I've known.
Maybe
some of the old Indian natives different parts of the country do it.
Could have
been, I don't know. There you go, Harry. Thank you, Dolly, for that little information. The time is now 3:30 and we are passing through Big Delta Junction and we're 96 miles.
Daughter, the Auburn.
Roadhouse. I brought Mrs. Adriana Corley a complete envelope of all the program and the history of this meet. Mrs. Corley is going through it now.
Yes, it seems to be very interesting.
I told them it was going to be hard to be there.
Well, I probably will as time goes on, but right now I feel like it's going to go.
Well, maybe next time we'll be able to go.
No, I'm not quite sure.
I don't know. Come on, take one. You are just like Jimmy McDonald. He wouldn't talk, but he finally said a couple of words, and I got him to open up.
Well, sir, I don't want to get started. I'm going to quit.
Go ahead.
Huh.
Okay. I'm going to try to ask you a question.
Well, Jimmy McDonald and George DeJohnny's finally caught up with us at Rich's, and they're all in here having a good time. We're getting ready to go again, to go home. Of course, George won't talk, and neither will Jimmy, but we're making up for it.
Well, we're 39 miles from home.
We're right here passing Aurora Lodge, and it's starting to rain a little bit. So we've had a wonderful trip up to now, and we have no complaints. We'll be passing Lynn Fletcher Creek very shortly. And by this location here, at about 38 miles, years ago there used to be a chicken rancher here with raised quite a few thousand chickens. But today it's just old rattle-shackle buildings here. And at this creek, Munson Creek here is a beaver dam. An old pipeline crosses here. We are now approaching the dike. We've just passed the house and field. And years ago at this location on the Richardson Highway, we used to come out and get our mess of grilling right along where the road is now. I've been fishing there many times and get a mess of fish in very few minutes. Well, times have changed. It's pretty well fished out now. You're lucky to get enough to eat.
Well, we're sailing along and approaching home base. And
what do you remember about this dike area?
Well, this dike area here, many years ago, before they put the dike in here, why, the waters of the Tanana River used to go through here and flood the country, that is, high water, and also the old town of Fairbanks in them days. And, that is, I went up Cushman Street clean out to the Tanana River in a rowboat. That's how bad the town used to be flooded until they put the dike in here.
That was about, what, 25, 30 years ago?
Oh, that was about maybe 35, 40 years ago. Well, we've been enjoying our trip, and we're not too tired, and it's starting to get a little bit dark, but everything seems to be going along pretty nice.
The time is now 5:35 p.m. on October the 2nd, 1961, and we're less than 18 miles from home.
Well, we completed our trip. I've delivered Frank Young and his wife to their house with their luggage, and I took Andrew Wicken home to his house with his buddy. And now unloading my car, and we completed a wonderful trip to the Pioneer Convention. Thank you for that. October 2nd,
I have a new 1961 copy of the Alaska Special Laws, and I'm going to read a law that was passed by the legislature. It's called House Concurrent Resolution Number 18. It is in regard to the Pioneer, proposed Pioneer Park project at Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm reading from page 233, about halfway down the page. House Concurrent Resolution Number 18, relating to the selection and classification of a certain tract of land in Fairbanks as recreational and cultural site. Be it resolved by the House in the second legislature of the first session assembled, the Senate concurring, whereas a tract of land in the center of the city of Fairbanks, namely Lot 12 and the southwest quarter of southwest quarter section of Section 9, Township 1, South Range, 1 West Fairbanks Meridian, containing 72.64 acres, has been made available for state selection, and the state has filed an application to select this tract of land, whereas, by reason of its location, this tract is ideally situated for recreational and cultural uses, and whereas the Pioneers of Alaska, a benevolent fraternal society of the state, are anxious to undertake and sponsor a program to develop this tract of land into a historical park with museums for the preservation and display of Alaska articles of historical value and great interest. And whereas this museum and park would be of great interest to the tourists and to continuing education and interest value to the local inhabitants, be it resolved by the House of Representatives of the Second Legislature, First Session Assembled, the Senate concurring that the Division of Lands, upon receiving a letter of tentative approval of its selection application from the Bureau of Land Management, is requested to classify this land for cultural and recreation use, and that it thereupon enter into a suitable agreement of lease or concession with the Pioneers of Alaska for the development and maintenance of this land as a historical park. Passed by the House on March the 7th, 1961, and passed by the Senate on April the 1st, 1961. That is the complete copy of the law as written in the session laws of 1961. This is Harry Hughes, Igloo 4, reading this under the tape for preservation of our permanent records of Igloo 4. Personal memorandum of October the 19th, 1961. The Town Hall, Utah Historical Society met at the Birch Park Recreation Hall, and we had for a speaker Dr. Herbert L. Heller of the Methodist University in Anchorage, Alaska. He talked on the early life of Lynn Smith, an early-day jeweler and United States Marshal in the Fairbanks area. The William Cashin of the Historical Society and of the University recorded Dr. Heller's talk. There were very good crowds there at the meeting. The hall was full, and he run on a picture projector, early day pictures of the Lynn Smith estate, which he has in his possession. He is from Indiana and has been very active in historical organization and educational work in both in Indiana and Alaska. He gave an excellent talk and encouraged the preservation and the acquiring of more knowledge and the protection of that residue and data in a safe place. He said the greatest loss to history is the Historical Society's basements and floods. In other words, this acquired knowledge has been lost after it has been accumulated, a great bit of it, through
poor judgment, negligence, and carelessness, and acts of God. They had a business session at the Historical Society that was cut brief, and they, Professor Kime, gave a very excellent talk on the composition of the historical magazine or book that is being formed. This is Harry Hughes. This is my little memorandum of my attendance to this meeting.
A law passed by the Alaskan legislature in 1961 called House Bill 97, establishing a tourist attraction development program and providing for an effective date. Be it annexed by the legislature of the state of Alaska, Section 1, any political subdivision of the state and any nonprofit organization formed under Act 1, Chapter 4, Title 36, Alaska Law, CLA 1949, or any bona fide nonprofit civic, paternal, or service organization which is certified as qualified as developing as one of its purposes tourist attractions, as hereafter described in Section 2 by the Commissioner of Commerce and Director of Division of Tourism, Department of Commerce, is eligible to apply for and receive tourist attraction development matching money from the state. Section 2. Tourist attraction development matching money may be secured by such subdivisions and organizations for the purpose of developing such tourist attractions and of historical and contemporary interest as are found to be worthwhile by the Commissioner of Commerce and Director of Tourism. Available monies will be divided in fair and equitable basis between applicants, and in no case shall any applicant receive more than $1,000 on first application. Tourist attraction development may include production, preservation, display of historical documents, artifices, totem poles, historical markers, native dances, basket tossing, native handicrafts, and art, and any other worthwhile tourist attraction dealing with Alaskan history or culture, but not in the preparation and distribution of community and other advertising material. In order to qualify for tourist attraction development matching money, a subdivision or organization must first submit and have approved by Commissioner of Commerce and the Director of Tourism any plans, programs, contracts, or agreements that will be used for carrying out the development of tourist attractions. Section 3. Any subdivision or organization found qualified to participate under the terms of this Act may receive $1 in state matching money for each dollar expended by the subdivision or organization for tourist attractions within the limits of available state appropriations and considering the needs of other qualified subdivisions and organizations. Section 4. This Act shall be administered by the Commissioner of Commerce and the Director of Division of Tourism. All participating subdivisions and organizations must submit to the Commissioner of Commerce and Director of Tourism complete reports covering both expenditure of state and local matching monies for tourist attraction programs. These reports, in the case of programs extending over 12 months, shall be submitted annually. Reports on shorter matching programs shall be submitted at the completion of the program. Section 5. Appropriations to carry out this Act should be made from the general fund. Section 6. This Act takes effect on the day after its passage and approval, or on the day it becomes law without such approval. Approved April the 18th, 1961. This is one law passed in 1961 in regard to aid to help develop tourist attractions in Alaska. This was read on the tape by Harry Hughes from the Laws of Alaska 1961 on page 141, 140 and 141.
This is October the 22nd, 1961, Fairbanks, Alaska. This is Harry Hughes and Frank Young at the home of Mr. Porcupile at 320 Farewell Avenue, Hamilton Acres. It's Sunday afternoon. Mr. Porcupile is going to talk and converse with a little for the Pioneer History on this tape recorder.
This is Iris W. Porcupile. I was born in Michigan, 8 July 14th,
14th, 1883. And our family moved to Nebraska about 3 or 4 years later, after I was born. And my brother farmed there for about 6 or 7 years. And then we moved to Seattle, where I got my formal schooling. And in 1904, I came to Alaska. I first landed off this ship in Solomon. I didn't get off at Nome the first time. I went to Solomon and I got a job there cooking for a camp. I cooked all that summer there for that camp. And towards the fall, or towards the end of the summer 1904, I came back to Nome, and there was a big excitement on the beach. I mean, the third beach had been struck, and I tried to get in on it too. So there was an old man there that had taken quite a fancy to me. I don't know why, but anyway, in fact, he wanted me to live with him and be his son. He had just lost his son, just about my age. And he offered to stake me. He says, I got a lot of claims out there on the third beach line. And he says, I'll stake you, and we'll go 50-50. And so he hired a man, and he furnished all the materials, oil and everything, and another man, we went out there. Well, as it happened, the third beach is getting pretty well started towards that, towards the end of the summer. And there were camps going up as far as you could see along the third beach. But at his property, laid west of Anvil Creek, and as it happens after, we found out that by a hard way, that the third beach line didn't extend west past the Anvil Creek, and we were unlucky to have those claims just there. Well, anyway, we worked there all winter. In fact, I went back after some work at another winter there, and we sunk deep holes weed. When we come to find out and have the stays made, we've been sinking past the level of the third beach. So the third beach line, wherever the pay was always on the same level. And we finally discovered that it's all been washed out by Snake River. And not at the mouth of Snake River like it was in the article the other day. It was back about 3 miles, I think it was, from the present beach, this third beach line was. Well, anyway, many of them, it was on the pay seek. It extended, the pay seek extended for about 6 miles, I guess, the third beach. There was many fortunes made there. In fact, the Brown, I forget his first name now, was made the discovery. We called him Little Creek Brown, because it was Little Creek that we first made that discovery. He got $1,000 pans. He didn't get it at first, but then when he got into the heart of the pastry, as it happens, it is not like most pastries, the third beach. It is concentrated from the waves. It is concentrated right down to a hard bedrock. It is a hard clay sand bedrock. And there was places there that there was a quarter of an inch of gold lying right on this hard bedrock. And of course, it was easy to scrape that off and get those $1,000 pans.